I'm going to start off reading from the book. Page 36, footnote 11. There are also a series of missed encounters in this book. The 10 people whom we invited accepted our invitation and withdrew from the project at a later date without contributing a written piece. I have a confession to make. In fact, I have a number of confessions to make. But you're here, I might guess, because you rather like confessions. The combination of queer sexualities and psychoanalysis will attract an audience inclined to relish, or at least to take an intellectual interest in, that which isn't normally spoken in public. So this is rather shameful. I am one of those missed encounters. I was supposed to be writing a piece for this wonderful volume, and I didn't. I remember the moment when I decided to withdraw, to renege on my commitment and to break my word to Noreen and Eve. Yes, I have a conscience, I really do. I was on holiday in Madeira in 2012. It was September, and we were staying in a charming little house up a very steep hill. The late summer swimming was fantastic. It was hot and sunny, and it should have been restful. But I'd brought out a large printout of contributions to Clinical Encounters with me. I was supposed to be reading them and writing my response. It was already overdue. It weighed on me. It was interrupting my holiday. I desperately needed a rest, but this was the only time I could possibly work on it. I wanted to read the papers. I wanted to contribute. After all, queer theory and psychoanalysis are two of my passions. But I decided to withdraw. I rationalised it in terms of my need for a break. It was an act of self-care. I might be letting Noreen and Eve down, but it was the sensible thing to do. And then 5.5 years later, I almost did it again. Good reasons again. I have too much work to do, don't we all? I have more pressing writing deadlines, articles overdue to editors of journal special issues, not to mention that book that isn't quite finished that Eve mentioned that's been sitting untouched since last September. And then there's the strike. Don't the terms, and some of you will know what I'm talking about, don't the terms of the strike that UCU members are on mean that I shouldn't actually be here taking part in a conference that is somehow associated with my work? And there's the action short of a strike, which says no voluntary activities, such as weekend working. I almost withdrew again from contributing to this project. But Noreen and Eve had very generously, very forgivingly invited me to speak today, and I had seriously contemplated withdrawing again. What is this repetition compulsion about? I could offer you an explanation in terms of the contemporary condition of academic life, its intense pressures and the systemic overcommitment with which academics all live. I could even add in a personal story of my complicity in that, in my choices that have enhanced these realities. And there'd be much truth in such an explanation. But there's more to it than that. Why would I sabotage my contribution to this groundbreaking, unique, field-defining book project? Well, I'm going to offer some thoughts from my perspective as a group analyst, which is part of the problematic, I think, at work here. I've been working in the broad terrain of queer theory since the mid-1990s. I was one of the people very privileged to be invited to Ireland when Noreen and Michael were organising those famous seminars. Queer theory became a lens to frame my understandings of the transformations in gender and sexuality that I was interested in. Transformations being enacted by social movements in popular culture and everyday life. I wrote about what I called the queer feminisms of Greenham Common, about the queering of intimate life, the decentering of the heterosexual couple, the proliferation of other ways of living and loving outside the co-residential heterosexual couple formation, about the valorization of queer sexualities in popular culture, the new emphasis on friendship. And alongside this, I was becoming interested in psychoanalysis, as I became increasingly dissatisfied with conventional sociological research methods and their assumption of the rational unitary subject, whose account of herself should be taken pretty much at face value. Indeed, I became so interested that I eventually decided that I wanted to train as a psychoanalyst. I wanted to practice, not just read, and attempt to apply psychoanalysis as part of my research. And because I decided I wanted the real thing, the hardest, the most prestigious, the most intensive learning experience, I embarked upon a 5 times a week analysis, and sometime later I applied to the Institute of Psychoanalysis. It's not that I didn't know, of course I knew. The history of the Institute's treatment of lesbians and gay men was an open secret, hardly written about, difficult to pin down with evidence and personal accounts, but certainly not a secret. Indeed, many friends and colleagues, sociologists, psychotherapists, feminists, warned me against applying, as did my mother. It would be a damaging experience, they said. Psychoanalysis hadn't changed. It was anti-feminist and anti-lesbian, homophobic to the core. But I'm strong-willed and ambitious, and I love a challenge. And I didn't think it would hurt me. After all, I've been out since I was 17, and I knew the world was changing. That was what my work was about. I predicted that the Labour government would introduce civil partnerships. The lone voice in my research group of feminists and family researchers who were convinced that it wouldn't. And I knew same-sex marriage was on its way. I remembered the shame and the secrecy of my teenage years, of Clause 28 and AIDS, the verbal abuse and the physical attacks on the streets in the 1990s, the homophobic press, the hidden lesbian nights at seedy clubs on Mondays, days that no one else wanted to go. And I knew it wasn't like that anymore. I'd been tracing the changes in my research and I'd been living them in my personal and social life. I was rejected by the Institute. Not utterly and totally. I was told I could reapply, the psychoanalytic version of revise and resubmit, but without the detailed feedback on what to revise. Yes, I had a good idea what was wrong about my application. It was perhaps premature. I'd only been in five times a week analysis for a year. But really the problem was that I was a lesbian and that I was a sociologist. One alone would have been difficult, but the two together made me an impossible candidate. The first killer question was, so can you tell me how you understand your sexuality? My reply began, I'm going to assume that you'd ask someone who identified as heterosexual that question. And I set off down a biographical narrative route, telling the story of how and when I came to see myself as a lesbian. The story of falling in love with a girl in the year above at school. A tale of teenage angst, of passion, heartache, sexual experimentation, moments of social exclusion and desolation as I imagined an old age of loneliness and cats. That wasn't what the analyst wanted to hear. No, she said, I mean, how do you understand the origin of your sexuality? I drew in a deep breath and paused. I'm not really sure that I believe in origins, in causes, not of sexuality, not of anything really. Things are much more complex than that. I'm too much of a postmodernist, too far removed from causal ways of thinking to be able to answer that question, I'm afraid. And I certainly don't see sexuality like that. I think sexuality is the complex product of many, many influences, historical, biographical, social, familial, cultural, biological even. I could expand on that, offer a theory of sexuality if that's what you want. It wasn't. That was the end of it for that interview. The second interview started to come apart with questions about my parents. I'd written a long essay about them as part of the application, about my relationships with them, about their relationships with each other. They'd met in Russia in the early 1960s. Neither were pro-Soviet, but they were socialists and they met at an international peace conference. The interview stalled around the relationship between socialism, sociology, and psychoanalysis. Was I a socialist? The analyst asked, like my parents. It was 2006. What was socialism in 2006? I'd been preparing a grant application about post-socialism in Bulgaria. My teenage identification had been with anarchism, anarcho-feminism, not socialism. My teenage rebellion against my open-minded, impossible-to-shock parents. In 1997, I'd believed that things could really get better, and I was still arguing with my ultra-critical, disillusioned friends and colleagues that I believed that they actually had. Was I a socialist? Compared with many, yes. Uncritically, no. Would I disavow the socialism of my parents and grandparents, my peace activism, their peace activism, my belief in redistribution, equality, global justice, the NHS, progressive taxation, the welfare state? No, absolutely not. But socialism and psychoanalysis are incompatible, was the response. Are they, I replied? I don't think so. And I'm hardly the only person who thinks that. What about the Frankfurt School? Fromm, Adorno, Horkheimer, Reich. And you're a sociologist? Yes. Sociology and psychoanalysis aren't compatible, are they? Now, that was a tricky question. In many ways, he was right. They aren't. Sociology as a discipline had taken little interest in psychoanalysis. Very few departments of sociology in the UK or the US have anyone in them with an interest in psychoanalysis. And psychoanalysis has shown little interest in sociology. But there have been sociologists of a psychoanalytic persuasion, very distinguished sociologists, Adorno, Horkheimer, Talcott Parsons, Nancy Chodorow, Ian Crabbe, Jessica Benjamin. Well, she's a social theorist more than a sociologist. I was running out of names. And there's me. I think that sociology and psychoanalysis can work together. I'm doing research in which I'm using psychoanalytically informed methods. I lost that interview too. I was a lesbian and a sociologist, and I couldn't be a psychoanalyst. At least I couldn't be an institute psychoanalyst. I knew that this was just one version of psychoanalysis, and I was critical of that. My interest had really been piqued by the feminist and relational psychoanalysis I was reading. That was what I loved. And by queer theoretical engagement with psychoanalysis, Judith Butler, Teresa de Laurentiis, Elizabeth Gross, David Eng, Leo Bassani. None of that was institute psychoanalysis. And I'd expected to be rejected. I wasn't surprised. But nonetheless, it hurt a little, and it made me angry a little, and it left its mark a little. Even though, as a result of that, I found group analysis. A few weeks after my rejection by the Institute, I headed around the corner from here to Dalham Gardens, and I attended the introductory weekend of the Institute of Group Analysis. And I was blown away. It was a powerful experience, moving, emotionally engaging, immersive, intellectually stimulating, and collective. I'd come of age at Greenham. Groups were in my blood. It wasn't just me and one other person in a room together, interminably, boringly, irritatingly. It was a group experience. It was social. It was at times interminable, boring, irritating. Other people are at times all of those things, and so am I. But it was sociology and psychoanalysis together, intimate, intention, battling it out, getting into bed together. At least that's how some of its practitioners and theorists narrated it. And it's how I came to see it. The psycho and the social, the individual and the group, the personal and the political, always mutually entangled, always conflictual. I was hooked. And so I trained as a group analyst. 8 years later, I was qualified. I could call myself a group analyst. I was a different person. I would dare to say a bit of a better person. A bit nicer, a bit more forgiving, a bit more generous. A bit less competitive, a bit less standoffish, a bit less insecure, a bit less self-excluding. I wasn't cured. You can't be cured of being a social being. But I had really experienced being a social being, and I'd learned a lot about myself, about relationality, and about the psychosocial. And perhaps above all, I'd learned about belonging and not belonging, about the psychosocial dynamics of inclusion and exclusion, about the subtle ways in which those psychosocial dynamics operate, and about my entanglement and complicity in them, about the force with which they impact upon me, resonating with my own family and biographical history at a particular moment in time. Amongst the people I trained, there were several lesbians and gay men, and whilst non-normative sexualities were, and are still not, anywhere near as carefully thought about as I think they should be, there is real space for the diversity of experience in group analysis. The group is, I believe, a space of queer potentiality and multiplicity in a radically different way from the dyadic encounter of analyst and analysand. Positions, identities, desires opened up, are challenged, played with in the group. Well, they can be, if the group analyst is able to allow this, if they can tolerate and enjoy the queerness of our relationality. There's a publicness, a sociality to group analysis that is the antithesis of psychoanalysis. Some think this means that group analysis can't go deep, that it can't tackle the complexities of sexuality, the darker aspects of desire, the anti-normativity and anti-sociality of sex. I don't agree. That isn't my experience. But that's for another time, and I don't have time. I've already had the finger. But that's my fault. I didn't contribute to the book. I could have had more words, more time, more space, had I not excluded myself. Why did I do that? I'm perhaps more willing now than I was in 2006 to think in terms of causes and origins. And I could cite my experience with institutionalised British psychoanalysis as part of the explanation. In 2012, on that holiday, I was nearing the end of my training as a group analyst, not a psychoanalyst. I wasn't a psychoanalyst. I wasn't doing the real thing that was meant to be brought into dialogue with queer theory in this book. And I'll confess there was part of me that doubted if I was really doing queer theory. I was too much of a sociologist, too engaged with real people's lives, with the everyday complex ordinariness of intimacy and sexuality and social change. It wasn't queer theory with a capital T. I'm a social scientist, not a humanities scholar. And in the cultural hierarchy of critical academia, the humanities trump the social sciences. Not that Noreen and Eve ever specified, even for 1 minute, that they wanted proper, pure institute psychoanalysis or queer theory with a capital T. But such is the power of cultural value, and it gets inside and we exclude ourselves, even those of us who like to think we know better. But I did make it here today. And I'd like to thank Eve and Noreen for persisting. I just wonder what the story was with the other 9 missed encounters. And 9, after all, is the perfect size for an analytic group.